Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Why do the Sudanese protests get so little news coverage? That's the title of a piece that ran in the Christian Science Monitor on Monday. Tom Murphy, a former aid worker, writes, quote, "If you've been following the Sudan Revolt's hashtag on Twitter and or read news sources such as Al Jazeera and Dawn's, the story of popular revolts against austerity measures in Sudan would not be new to you. But if you happen to be the majority of people, you likely do not know much more about Sudan than Darfur, and maybe heard something in regards to conflict between Sudan and South Sudan. The latter group can be excused because most reporting has ignored Sudan." Anti-government demonstrations began on June 16th at the University of Khartoum. Since then, protests have spread to other parts of the country. Human Rights Watch reports that security forces have responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition. Hundreds of citizens and journalists have been arrested and beaten. Joining us to talk about the difficulties involved in covering Sudan is Salma El-Wardani. She's Africa correspondent with Bloomberg. On June 26, Salma was deported from Khartoum. On June 21st, she was detained without charge while covering the anti-regime demonstrations. And then on June 26, she went to the press center to renew her credentials and was informed of her immediate expulsion and was escorted by security agents to the airport. Salma is an Egyptian who co-founded the Egyptian daily news website Aram Online. And Salma joins us from Cairo. Hi, Salma. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. Thank you for joining us. And we are also joined by Justin Elliott. He's a reporter with ProPublica, an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism. Justin was previously a reporter at Salon.com and TPM and news editor at Talking Points Memo. He was also a fact checker at Mother Jones and has written for a number of other publications. He reports on everything from political ads and transparency, which we'll talk about later in the show, to drones and the NYPD overstating its counterterrorism record. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
It's great to have you. So as we always do, we like to give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Justin, why don't we start off with you? Where did you see good reporting this week?
Yeah, in the political realm, there was a really good story. I believe it actually came out this morning on Politico by a reporter there, Ken Vogel, revealing one of the biggest donors to Crossroads GPS, which is this Karl Rove-backed group that is one of the biggest sort of conservative outside groups in the country. And the donor they revealed is Steve Wynn, who is a casino mogul who owns a bunch of casinos and resorts in Las Vegas and also Macau. And his name had never been reported before in this context because Crossroads GPS is one of these groups that doesn't have to reveal their donors. So they were able, through sources, to identify him as having given millions of dollars. So I thought that was kind of a big deal and also a good example of, persistent reporting.
And so Steve Wynn is giving millions of dollars to Crossroads.
Exactly. And it's also interesting because he actually used to be a Democrat, but now he's turned very, very anti-Obama.
Right, because this is sort of funny, but Business Week ran a piece about Steve Wynn going vegan and offering vegan options at all of his Las Vegas hotels, and that got a lot of attention in the vegetarian community. And I was reading that he was more Democratic back then. So what switched, and why is he giving so much money? What does he want for his money?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I don't know that it's that being vegan and Republican are mutually exclusive. But I guess we have a case in point here with Steve Wynn. But I mean, he has gone on for the last couple of years. He's been going on Fox News saying that he believes Obama is anti-business. He's against Obama's health care bill. He's in terms of what he wants for his money. I mean, he has his company, Wynn Resorts, has had a lobbying presence in Washington, lobbying, unsurprisingly, around gambling issues. They've tried to get online gambling legalized and that sort of thing. So it's obvious, he has business interests before the federal government. That's clear.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk more about this later in the show and also talk about how do you get this information because it is so secretive. So thank you for that. So, and we'll talk about that later in the show. And Salma, what about you? Where are you seeing good reporting of Sudan at a time when most media outlets are writing about why it's not getting much reporting? Salma, are you with us?
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
So where are you seeing good reporting about Sudan at a time when media outlets are questioning why it's not getting much coverage?
Well, security forces and, you know, the regime in Sudan have systematically blocked the voices from the street and, you know, muzzled the media. They have mounted a huge campaign of detention against, you know, everyone who dares to uncover, you know, the protest and, you know, what's going on in Sudan. From, you know, there's a huge campaign of detention against activists, you know, journalists, photographers, opposition figures, youth groups and protesters. Some of them are being threatened and detained for a long period and have not been released yet, and the detainees have been subjected to different forms of torture. So it's really, really difficult to cover, you know, generally, even before the latest protests, it's generally difficult to report on protests or on politics in Sudan. I mean, you know, politics which is away from, you know, the official announcements and the official statements. It's really, really difficult. It's a very difficult job for journalists in Sudan. So, you know, whoever tries to, you know, take photos of the protests or interview activists or, you know, give voices for the people who don't have voices is arrested and harassed.
And because this isn't getting much attention, why don't you take us back and talk about what sparked the protests? The demonstrations started in June when the government raised transportation and fuel prices and boosted taxes and devalued the currency to cope with the loss of about 75% of the nation's oil output when South Sudan seceded in just recently. So can you talk a little bit about what really sparked these protests and who's involved?
Yeah, like as you said, the protest broke out in the very beginning, the female students' hostels at the University of Khartoum on June 16. They were, you know, the students' movement started condemning the removal of subsidies. Hello?
Yes, you're here. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. So it started inside the campus, students calling for the removal of subsidies on fuel and the rise of prices. But then when the police responded and the security responded with violence and crackdown on the female students, the next day, overnight, it expanded into an anti-regime, all-out uprising. Protesters first chanted no to price rising, but then the next day they were chanting no, down with the regime, and people want the regime down. It first started inside the campus, and then it's expanding inside and outside the Khartoum in different neighborhoods. Many people are involved with youth groups like Grifna and Sharara and Sudan Change Now, and people, you know, who are not politicized or you know, who are not members of any parties, but they're just, you know, speaking out against the government, and they are joining the movement.
And why don't you, and I want to apologize to our listeners, we're connecting with Salma in Cairo, so I'm sorry for her bad line. And if you have any questions for her about Sudan and the lack of coverage, what have you seen in the media? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Salma, why don't you talk about what happened to you? On June 21st, you were detained without charge while covering the demonstrations, and then 5 days later, you went to the press center to renew your credentials. What happened at that point?
Yeah, first I was, you know, covering on Thursday. It was June, I think, 23. I was covering I was trying to cover demonstrations in Sudan, in Khartoum University. And then I was waiting in the car with a friend of mine. She's also a journalist and activist. And we were waiting for the administration to go out of the university to cover. But then six big men, they approached the car and they shouting and pounding on our car. They said, "What are you doing? Are you taking photos?" And then they asked us, they drove us to the outskirts of the city for interrogation in one of those ghost houses that is the security, the national intelligence security cells. They seized our laptops and mobile phones, and then they removed all the photos and videos of the photos that I have on my laptop, and they asked me for the password. And then they started interrogating me, and then they released me later after all, the campaigns that were happening in Egypt to release me. And then they took my accreditation card, and they told me they had to go to the press council to decide. 3 days later, they suddenly decided to deport me. They took me to the airport and they just deported me.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists has written about a number of journalists who have been deported.
Exactly.
Authorities have raided media offices, a journalist's home. One journalist was arrested. So clearly, if you're going to arrest and deport journalists, it's incredibly hard to get the story out. But what are some of the other reasons that this is not getting much attention? Tom Murphy, the former aid worker who wrote a piece in the Christian Science Monitor, explores a number of different explanations. He says tying this uprising to the Arab Spring has been difficult because the Sudanese have not been able to occupy anything, not even a public square. And so an outlet like CNN can't camp out in one place, for example, making it difficult to report. He says those answers are incredibly simplistic. So what is it? Why aren't these demonstrations getting more attention?
Well, yeah, that's true. That's one reason is that the movement is still, compared to the numbers we've seen in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, they're still small in numbers, but it's expanding. And this is true. It's true. It's very difficult for journalists to access protesters because, just maybe 1 hour maximum and the police comes and disperses the protest. So even if you're going to cover a demonstration, when you arrive, it's already over. So, it's until now, they haven't occupied any square or anything that becomes the center of the protest and that provides protection for journalists to cover and to shoot. At the same time, activists are being harassed and the phones are being bugged, so it's very difficult to conduct interviews with them unless, under very, very harsh security precautions. So, yeah, that's another reason.
And Justin, have you been following this issue?
I haven't. As you say, I've been struck by the lack of coverage. But I actually had a question for Salma. I'm curious if there's been much international reaction to the protests, including American reaction. Have foreign governments been getting involved or even making statements at this point?
Well, there are some, human rights human rights group and Amnesty are continuously, trying to uncover, to issue reports and urging the Sudanese government to stop crackdown protesters and release the Sudanese. But it's still Sudan revolt. No idea why, but it's not, grabbing the international attention that we, for example, in Egypt, we were grabbing the whole world attention. But in Sudan, for some reason, there's not only because of the media blackout, but there's no one is following. I don't know why.
And when you were there, Salma, what did you hear from people in the streets? It's interesting to read about The role that social media is playing, especially with young people. Internet penetration in Sudan is low. About 10% of the population has access to the internet. 15% have mobile phones, but local news websites and Twitter accounts run by young activists have been vital to getting information out. And again, the hashtag is Sudan Revolts. So what were you hearing on the ground from young people?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, as you said, like, internet is not widely used, like the case in Egypt and other Arab countries. But in Sudan, it started from normal students, not activists, like people from normal students did not access for anything, and they were, you know, shouting out against the government. And they were trying to say no to Bashir,
Salma. I think we lost her. We were connecting with Salma al-Wardani in Cairo. And again, I'm sorry for her line, but I think we just lost her. And I did want to just bring up one more point about this, because she brought up President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. And he recently said, protesters speak about the Arab Spring. I should say that we in Sudan have an incinerating summer, which will burn down all of its enemies. So pretty damning words there, Justin, from Bashir.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to your original point, I mean, like, it is shocking how little coverage this has gotten. But, you know, it actually hasn't been going on that long. So I wonder if this is just kind of a delayed reaction. And assuming protests continue, I mean, I think, you know, the international media is going to have to step up, and I assume we'll start hearing more about it.
Right. And it's also interesting. It's incredibly difficult because journalists are getting deported. And then with social media, you've got, again, 10% of the population has access to the internet.
Right. Although, you know, with Syria, for example, it's also extremely difficult and dangerous for journalists to get in there on the ground, although a few brave journalists have. So mostly what you've seen is people setting up in neighboring Lebanon and reporting from there, which is imperfect, but there's still obviously been a lot of coverage.
Yeah, right.
And there are ways around that.
Right, same thing with Iran.
Exactly.
Right. And Salma, are you back with us?
Yeah, sorry, the line is very bad.
Oh, actually, your line is much better this time around. So what about that? We were just talking about the fact that if you report on activities, say, for example, inside Iran or in Syria, you have no choice but to do it from a neighboring country. So, do you know, are reporters trying to do that in this case?
Me, for example, I'm trying now to cover the Sudan from Cairo. So I'm depending on, you know, making some Skype calls, because telephones are bugged and you can't, you don't want to harm your sources, you know. So, yeah, I'm trying to cover using international reports, using my sources inside Khartoum. Using Twitter, I'm trying to, now it's extremely, extremely difficult to get to report on the ground from Khartoum. There's another Egyptian journalist who is now spending 12 days in custody. No one knows her whereabouts, and she was also trying to cover demonstrations.
And I wanted to ask you, when we got cut off, I read a quote, a damning quote from al-Bashir saying that we in Sudan have an incinerating summer which will burn down all of its enemies. What can you tell us about him and his hold on power?
Yeah, I mean, the regime in Sudan is very, very weak and very fragile. They already have their own problems. They have, you know, they have that conflict with South Sudan. They have shutdown of oil. They can't. There's the mismanagement of conflict on all fronts. There's the mismanagement of the diversity in Sudan. They have economic. The inflation has reached 37% last month. High unemployment, high prices. They have the problems, but. Again, they're following the same, they're in the footsteps of other fallen regimes in Egypt and Tunisia and Middle East uprising, that they're trying to show that, no, we have no problem. and there are no protests, and there's no Arab Spring in Sudan, and you know, the same cliche that Sudan is not Egypt, is not Tunisia, is not Libya, and we're different, we're successful, we will go on, we have democracy here, so it's the same. They're, you know, in the same line with other dictatorships.
And Salma, did you happen to catch the photo journal spread that got a lot of attention in the New York Times that focused on children in Sudan?
Sorry, I didn't get you.
Did you or Justin? The New York Times came out with several incredible photos a couple of weeks ago, focusing on children in Sudan. Basically, it's a new Lost Boys of Sudan. Justin, did you hear about this or see this?
I didn't actually. Most of the Sudan or related coverage I've been reading is actually about the first anniversary of South Sudan becoming a nation.
Right. Well, yes, the New York Times has this incredible photo journal of Sudanese children in exile, and this photojournalist Tyler Hicks was able to find children who are literally walking to try to find safety because, in many cases, their parents have been killed. So, Salma, I don't think people understand just how dire this situation is. I mean, these photos are just jarring to look at. Can you talk about just how jarring the situation is in Sudan?
Yeah, like I told you, the regime is very weak now. The country is economically, in all fronts, it's deteriorating. There's international isolation in Sudan. There's diplomatic isolation. There is economic sanctions in Sudan. There is high inflation, high unemployment, high prices. There is mismanagement of conflicts, mismanagement of the diversity. There is marginalization of different groups. So it's really deteriorating. And now with the removal of fuel subsidies, it's really, really difficult with people to cope up with the new austerity package that is announced. You know, add to this the repression, the continuous repression on citizens and their freedoms of expression and, you know, freedoms of belief. So, in all fronts now, it's really, really hard for this regime to survive.
We're talking about 60,000 refugees who've been told to move south, but they say they're not going because the soil is bad. Further to the south, would you say this is a failed state?
Sorry?
Would you say that Sudan is a failed state?
Yeah, the government cannot manage any. Cannot manage on all fronts. It's failure.
And so, what is in store here? Just in the last 30 seconds, what story do you want to tell about what's happening in Sudan? Well, we lost Salma, and we're about to go to break. I'm glad that we reconnected, and luckily her line was better at that point. We were talking with Salma Al-Wardani. She is Africa correspondent for Bloomberg. On June 21st, she was detained without charge while covering the anti-regime demonstrations, and then 5 days later, she went to the press center to renew her credentials and was escorted by security agents to the airport. And according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, anti-government demonstrators have been tear gassed. They've been hit with live ammo. Hundreds of citizens and journalists have been arrested and beaten. And we will continue to cover this. Hopefully, journalists will be able to cover it from a neighboring country. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk with Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica, about the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being raised in the political campaigns. Where is the coverage about where that money is being spent? How is it affecting media coverage? You can join us 866-798-8255. This is your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, where every week thousands of listeners tune in to KALW, but not at 91.7, but via our online streams at kalw.org. So if you travel outside the Bay Area, or if there are times when you encounter the limits of our signal, the online stream's a great way to stay connected. And if you have a smartphone, you can listen on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Just click the Listen Live link at the front page of kalw.org. You'll see all the options. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local Public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. We also just redesigned a new weekly newsletter that'll let you know what's coming up and let you know how you can get involved. On Monday, we will do a show about a fracking in California. Is fracking happening in California? Where is it happening? Why aren't we getting more information about this? And how are communities responding? We are also putting shows together next week about how underwater life, whales and dolphins are being held captive at water parks like SeaWorld. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we are going to switch gears now and talk about coverage of the hundreds of millions of dollars, we should say billions, actually, that are being raised for the presidential elections. How is this money being raised? Who is giving the money? And where is it being spent? That is one of the big questions we really want to talk about, because we get a lot of stories about the money being raised, but how is it being spent? Well, it's being spent on ads at the very media outlets that are supposed to cover the candidates. So how is that also affecting coverage? We're joined by Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica, an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism. And now I would like to welcome Dave Leventhal. Dave reports on political influence issues for Politico. Before joining Politico, Dave worked for 2 years as editor at the Center for Responsive Politics, where he oversaw the center's journalism and provided analysis to a number of media outlets. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you today.
It's great to have you. So, Dave, I want to ask you before we dive in here, in terms of really good reporting this week, where did you see good reporting? Who would you like to give kudos to?
Well, there's been a whole number of stories, a host of stories from a variety of outlets. The Wall Street Journal had a big story about labor. There was a story by USA Today that delved into Mitt Romney's money. And pretty much, I think, a theme that you're seeing in this election cycle is that most major news organizations have reported who are covering the money game, money in politics, exclusively, or at least in large part, given their various beats. So it's really kind of provided a pretty rich tapestry of media coverage of these types of issues, and it kind of speaks to the largesse of the issue and the amount of money that is going into politics, money like we've really never seen it before in any other federal political election in U.S. history. This by far is going to be the most expensive political campaign in American history, well exceeding what we saw in 2008, which at that point was the most expensive in U.S. history as well.
Right. It seems like there's no end in sight here. A study by the research firm Borrell Associates projects that election spending in 2012 will reach a stratospheric $9.8 billion. So almost $10 billion. Initially, I thought it was going to be between 6 and 7.
Give or take a couple of billion.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't say that, to be glib. It's really the truth. There is really no telling at the end of the day how much money is going to be spent. But what we know is this, that much of it is being driven by outside political organizations, groups that can raise and spend unlimited sums of money. They can advocate for or against politicians or political causes. And as a result of that financial largesse, you're seeing just so many millionaires and in some cases billionaires dumping in millions or tens of millions of dollars into these causes in order to go and promote a political ideology or to promote a candidate because they espouse a certain political ideology. It's unprecedented in part because of Supreme Court and federal court decisions from a couple of years ago that really broadened the channel in the ability for wealthy Americans to go and spend more than they ever have before in as strong a way as they possibly can in the political game.
Mm. And Justin, you brought up earlier a piece showing that Steve Wynn, the man who owns so many hotels in Las Vegas, is now spending millions on Crossroads, Karl Rove's super PAC. The question that we have, when we're talking about $10 billion, so much money, President Obama comes to California on a number of occasions, charging $38,000 per plate. In fact, he'll be in Oakland soon. Where is this money going, and why isn't that getting more attention?
In terms of where it's going, I mean, conventionally speaking, the rule of thumb is that campaigns spend about three-quarters of the money they take in on advertising, and the majority of that is spent on what they call TV spot advertising. So this is ads bought on local television stations. So that is really where the majority of the money is going. Obviously, the sort of middlemen in that process, the ad buyers, the ad-making firms, the political consultants, and so on, are all taking home, generous amounts of money. But the greatest chunk is really going to the TV stations.
So this is a windfall for media companies.
It is. What I've been writing about in the last several months is a new rule that looks like it's going to go into effect in August. This was passed by the Federal Communications Commission, and it's going to require television stations to post on a new government website information about political ad spending, who's buying ads, how much they're paying, and sort of where they're running, among other information. So we should get a sort of more granular look at that side of the ledger if this rule goes into effect as expected next month.
So, Dave, if this is a windfall for media companies, like General Electric, for example, and all of the corporations that own the TV outlets, then the next obvious question is, how does that affect their coverage of the campaigns?
It has put some media outlets in kind of an awkward position where you'll have media outlets, either through the National Association of Broadcasters or other lobbying groups, actually lobbying against rules that their own journalists are writing about. Now, I trust, whether it's here or any other publication, that at least in theory there should be a very strong firewall between the business end and the journalism end. That's of course, what the principle would dictate, and there's nothing to indicate that wall, sacred wall, many journalists would consider it, has been broken down. But of course, as this goes on, it does put some of these companies in, I guess you could say, an awkward position, and we'll see how that plays out in the coming months, especially as this rule goes forward.
That is Dave Leventhal. He reports on political influence for Politico, and Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica. And we'd love to hear from you. Even we're grappling with this behind the scenes. When we're talking about how we should cover the election, we don't want to cover the everyday horse race, he said, because that doesn't do anything to move the conversation forward. The money in politics is crucial. And so we're all kind of thinking, how should we cover this moving forward? What do you want from media reports on the upcoming election, specifically the billions of dollars that are being spent? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you think of the coverage so far? Do you think it goes far enough? Are you seeing any analysis about the fact that these billions is a windfall for the media companies that are supposed to be covering these campaigns? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Justin, what are some of the challenges you're facing in trying to make this transparent? Because reporters are following the candidates closely. They tend to just sort of play sound bites. But the fundraisers are often out of reach. They're private. Journalists are not allowed to cover them. For example, President Obama's campaign workers confiscate guests' cell phones and then put them in plastic bags because they don't want video to end up on YouTube. So why aren't people raising, sort of saying, hey, this is not right to exclude reporters from these events?
I mean, in that particular case, I think it's because, news organizations to some extent depend on the campaigns for access, so you kind of have to pick your battles on that. But in general, I'd say that we have pretty good campaign finance laws from a transparency perspective, so ultimately, even if you can't get into those fundraisers, the Obama campaign will have to report to the Federal Election Commission who's giving money. So you'll learn about it in a relatively short amount of time. And that the same goes for super PACs. But what's new, or not new, but what's expanded this cycle is these new groups. The use of them has been greatly expanded. These are 501c4s, a type of nonprofit, also called a social welfare group. The group Crossroads GPS that I mentioned before is an example of this. These are groups that, because of tax law, don't have to reveal their donors. So that's really an area that's been greatly expanded of sort of dark money. We have no idea who's giving to them. It could be individuals. It could be corporations. The article I was mentioning earlier on Politico by some of Dave's colleagues reported through just their own through sources, through unnamed sources, that the casino mogul Steve Wynn is one of the major donors to Crossroads GPS. But, I mean, that type of article, which I'm assuming took a lot of work, is really the exception, and they had to get someone to talk. So, I mean, a lot of this is still going on in the shadows and will most likely stay in the shadows probably forever unless there's some sort of change in the law or in the court. So this is really the first election where there's a huge amounts of money that are being spent, and we don't know where it's coming from.
And so what is a reporter's responsibility in this case, Dave? I mean, it's all new territory now.
It certainly is to a degree, and I think as you're talking about specifically these nonprofit organizations that can spend incredible sums of money on politics but do not have to disclose their donors, a lot of reporters, and certainly we've been trying, and Justin's been trying, and many other people have been trying to really get to the bottom of who is behind it, because, you know, on one hand, you do have the argument that, well, who cares? What's the big deal here? And there are organizations and people who will make the case that it's really not necessary to the democratic process, or it's not really all that important to know person by person, dollar by dollar, who is donating to political groups or to political candidates. But on the other end, you have the idea that transparency is sort of the ultimate elixir to government corruption or political campaigns that are dominated either by corporations or wealthy individuals. So at the very least, transparency needs to be an important element to it. So you can subscribe to either theory, but at least as far as we're concerned, we're trying to do the best that we can to show in as much richness as possible and as much detail as possible who is doing what, because this is a campaign, of course, that is going to be voted on by the American people and not by corporations or unions or special interest groups. And people should have a pretty good idea of exactly what's going on at the end of the day with the campaigns that are trying to promote themselves and get people to vote for them.
Well, and it's also interesting to see how this is being spun by the campaigns, because you had the Obama campaign recently come out and send out an email saying, you know, if we don't raise more money, we are going to lose because we are being outspent. And then when you look at the numbers, you find that Democratic groups have actually eclipsed Republicans. This is according to the Daily Beast, Daniel Stone. He got information from the Federal Election Commission. Democratic groups have raised about $157 million, which is a sizable advantage to Romney and the Republicans. They would have to bring in about $40 million more than Obama every month until November to outraise the president. But then when you look at the super PACs, the Republicans are just flying by the Democrats. So you have, for example, conservative casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, who funded Newt Gingrich's campaign, recently gave $10 million to the super PAC Restore Our Future. I love these names. That's one of the Romney super PACs. And then Forbes, in a recent interview with Forbes, said he's going to spend $100 million. And then Texas billionaire Harold Simmons has shelled out about $20 million to a variety of GOP super PACs. No Democrat is in the same league. You've got like Jeffrey Katzenberg spent $2 million to two Democratic super PACs, but they're in the single digits where the Republicans are giving double digits.
Without question, and whether you like it or not, for better or for worse, Republicans have been much quicker to the punch to adjust and to adapt to the new laws and the new regulations that have been put in place not 3 years ago. And as a result, they've been able to really marshal their donor pool to get the big dollars coming in and flowing in, while the Democrats, led by Barack Obama himself, were railing against the new decisions that had been made, saying that it's wrong, that they need to be reversed. But then they found themselves in a very awkward position. And back in February, Barack Obama himself endorsed unlimited giving to a super PAC that was supporting his campaign. So after 2 years of effectively, again, railing against the system, he had to change course and say, well, hey, the political reality is the way that it is. We have to play by the rules that have been given to us, even if we do not like the rules, and it's okay to start doing this. Now, a lot of people have been very, very slow to actually take his advice, and this is a kind of the conundrum that the Democrats are facing right now, is that they have to play by the rules that are given to them until they change, but yet a lot of folks just don't want to swallow hard and actually go along with the rules as the way that they are right now.
And I would just add to that, I mean, a cynical reading of both parties' positions on campaign finance laws and regulations is that they're driven entirely by self-interest. I mean, as Dave mentioned, Obama, you know, claims to be against the Citizens United decision and they talk against super PACs and so on, but then had to come out and ask Democrats to start giving to their own super PACs. And then if you go back to the 2008 election, Obama famously also flipped on the question of public financing. He was originally going to accept public financing for his campaign, then realized he could raise a lot more money if he opted out of that system. And that was considered the moment when the public financing system for presidential campaigns really died, when he made that decision. So, I mean, you have to look at sort of the party's self-interest in their statements and positions on campaign finance.
And Barack Obama has actually been a disappointment to many campaign finance reformers who expected that he was going to come in during his first term and really shake things up.
We
heard a story a couple weeks ago that kind of enumerated the different things that that in their opinion, the reformers' opinion, he has failed on or he has not done. Now, the Obama campaign and the administration will say, we still are at the forefront of these issues. We will do a much better job than any Mitt Romney administration will do, and especially if we get another chance, if we get reelected and go into a second term, this will be at the top of our agenda. And the reformers come back and say, well, we'll believe it when we see it.
Right. We're going to hear that a lot. Just reelect us. We promise we'll keep our promises this time. Today, we're speaking with Dave Leventhal, reporter with Politico, and Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica. And we have about 8 minutes left. So if you'd like to weigh in on this and give us your opinions about media coverage of this very important issue, again, we are talking about a presidential campaign, well, an election, really, that will cost almost $10 billion at a time when poverty rates are skyrocketing, inequality is skyrocketing. Bay Citizen just had a piece about Californians who can't afford to eat. So this is a really important issue. What do you think about coverage? What questions should reporters be asking? And really, the money is going to the very media companies that are supposed to cover these campaigns. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Aaron in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago, so forgive me if I stumble over anything that's already been said, but my wife is actually a fairly involved and, as I understand it, a pretty good volunteer fundraiser for the Obama campaign on a national level. And one of the things that she's, like, that they've been hearing internally within the fundraising apparatus that you guys just touched on, like the big pitch internally and then that they go out to the donors with, you know, is basically, we're being so outraised, and we're going to be outspent, and that's just going to cost us the election.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought that this is just a personal theory that I've kind of want to run by the panel there to see if this makes sense to anyone else. Like, I get there's all this money, and that seems really poisonous and bad, and all of these things. But it seems to me that there's a real element of diminishing returns if you accept as a given, which I think we all do, that the election is really not truly a national election. It's a state-by-state election. And the decision is ultimately going to be made in something like 9 to 13 states, right? So if you've got all the money in the world to advertise in those states, at some point, how much money can you really spend on television advertisements in Cleveland and, you know, and Detroit and Charlottesville, Virginia, and places where the election is really being contested. You know, advertising in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and Dallas and New York and Houston is ultimately, as we understand it, electorally pointless.
Right.
So does that, like, you know, does that make sense to anyone else, that logic? Like, how much money can you really spend effectively in a limited number of states? So that's my thought, and I really have no idea if that's right, but it just seems to me like, how far does $1 billion go when you've really only got 10 or 11 states to fight over?
Well, thank you. Justin, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's an interesting theory. I mean, first of all, I'll just say, you know, look, I mean, Florida is a big state with a lot of media markets, so the amount of money that you could spend there is quite high. I mean, I think the caller has a point, but if you assume that this is going to be an election decided by very thin margins, I think from the campaign's perspective, you know, a money advantage, if you're talking very thin margins in individual states, can change that margin. So I mean, there, to some extent, you know, we won't know the answer until we get the results and we can sort of look at how much was spent and what the margins were. But I don't think they're taking any chances. They're trying to jockey for advantage as much as possible. So that's just what they're going to do.
And Dave, anything to add?
I apologize. I wasn't able to hear the caller's audio. So if you don't mind recapping, I'm happy to weigh in.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just quickly. He basically said it comes down to about 13 states or so, 11 to 13 states. That's where the candidates really need to put their focus. Putting an ad in San Francisco is, for the most part, a waste of money. So, you know, raising billions and billions of dollars doesn't really make sense when you're focusing on such a small amount of states.
And there's probably some truth to that. Certainly there are a number of states that could be considered to lean one way or another. So you may see and have already seen a lot of investment in states that would be considered perhaps marginal for the candidates. Or, you know, they may strategically decide that a certain state that doesn't appear to be cutting their way at this point would be kind of a good gamble so that they're going to invest a little bit more. Or, say, for example, Mitt Romney just sees the math, for the electoral math, cutting Barack Obama's way, which a lot of polls and a lot of studies presume that it's going to, then he may try to make a play in some of those states with a lot of cash, or for that matter, the super PACs or the other outside groups may try to make a play with a lot of cash in those types of states. So it really remains to be seen what exactly is going to happen in that regard, because we just haven't gotten to the full-on go season just yet, but that's going to come up very soon, and
a lot
of money regardless.
Well, the Washington Post just reported that the two sides are poised to spend $100 million on ads just in the next month, $85 million on TV spots from Romney and $110 from the Obama side.
So just imagine what it's going to be like in September, October, and November.
Yikes. Well,
right. And just to give an example of what Dave's talking about in terms of this tactic of sort of broadening the field, I remember in the 2008 Obama versus McCain election, there was a point later on in which the Obama campaign started to run some ads and I believe do some robocalls in Arizona, McCain's home state. And the McCain campaign then itself was running robocalls in his home state, I assume, as sort of a defense to that, even though Obama didn't really have a chance there. So you see that sort of jockeying a lot in these
right.
national elections.
Well, thank you for the call, Aaron. And we have time for one more call. Let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose. Yeah, I just wanted to say you guys were covering this topic, but Mr. Obama set the tone in 2008 when he did not accept matching funds, and that started off this huge money-making enterprise that's going on now. And then when you have the Supreme Court knock out over 100 years of established law, the Tillman Act in 1906, done by Teddy Roosevelt, and just open the doors to corporate funding and all these super PACs, has really made us a non-democracy, non-republic anymore. It has really turned into an oligarchy.
Mm.
That's it. We have an oligarchy. It is plain and simple. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it's turning a lot of people off, that's for sure. And, you know, what happens to other views? How do they get in? For example, Jill Stein with the Green Party. Is she going to get any coverage at all? And then I wanted to just ask you, because we're about to end the show, I just got an email from the Sunlight Foundation, and they've got a big campaign on the Disclose Act, which will be debated on the Senate floor on this Monday. And the Disclose Act would require corporations, unions, super PACs, and other secretive nonprofits to report within 24 hours of making a campaign expenditure of $10,000 or more. What's your read on this, Dave? According to this email, the Republicans are going to filibuster.
It looks like this is dead on arrival, and there's some question as to whether it's even going to get through the Senate and even have a chance to be heard in the House, where it will almost certainly be killed. So it, at the very least, and we were reporting on it today, that it appears that the advocates for the Disclose Act are merely at this point just trying to use it as an opportunity to revisit some of these issues, to shine light on this issue, but don't really even themselves think that it has much of a chance at all of actually going forward, at least legislatively.
And how many politicians actually support this act? Are they all Democrats?
Of, people serving in Congress?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I don't have an exact number to cite for you, but it is not a majority.
Right.
Because certainly in the House, almost all Republicans are against it. John McCain on the Senate side, who has been a campaign finance reformer, bar none on the Republican side. The McCain-Feingold Act of 2002, you may remember, of course, is named after him.
Right.
Even he's come out against it. So the cards are really stacked against this, and it just doesn't seem like this version of it, similar to the version of it that went forward in 2010, really has any chance at all.
Wow. Well, we will definitely follow this issue, and we will be seeing in the next couple of months hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being spent, given to the media outlets that are supposed to cover these campaigns. So thank you both for your work, and hopefully you can keep uncovering the details of who's giving money to which campaign. Dave Leventhal reports on political influence issues for Politico, and Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. And here's what's coming up on Monday. What's in store for the future of fracking in California? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about hydraulic fracturing, which involves blasting huge amounts of chemicals, sand, and water into the ground, which enables trapped oil and gas to escape. How much fracking is happening in California? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Who's pushing for fracking in California, and how are communities organizing against it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, big money dominates the presidential campaign trail. Is the money race getting out of hand? We'll talk about it. Political pundit James Carville makes the case for supporting and defending the middle class this election year. And Bill Banfield pays tribute to the late jazz pianist Billy Taylor in his essays of note on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at noon here on KALW San Francisco, 91.7, your local public radio station. Next, we take you to the BBC World Service in London for World Have Your Say. Then it's Tavis Smiley at noon and Smiley and West at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, Ben James here. Welcome to World Have Your Say, the BBC's global discussion programme where you're in charge.
It's a new massacre, by the Assad regime. This very small village, which is no more than 11,000 people, was visited by a very big number of armored vehicles and tanks.
What's going on in Syria? Yet again, there are reports of a massacre, with each side blaming the other. We're going to put your questions on the state of the country, the quality of information, the opposition, the diplomacy, to a couple of experts on Syria. Whatever you want to talk about, we'll discuss. Post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, why do people climb mountains? After 9 climbers died in an avalanche in the French Alps, some of you are asking if it's worth the risk. We'll hear a group of mountaineers talk it through.